often been said you can't tell a book by its title, and I suppose that's true, but occasionally a title is so good that you just can't resist it. Now, lots and lots of people send me emails wanting me to use their textbooks in my various classes, and I got one recently from a lawyer named Jeremy Geltzer, and I was just about to delete it when all of a sudden I noticed the title of his book. He calls it Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures, Film and the First Amendment. Yeah, me too. So though I'm not using it in one of my courses at the moment, we're going to talk all about it today. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today it's all about, well, dirty words and filthy pictures.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
The First Amendment has something called the Free Speech and Press Clauses, and these are very important. In fact, many people consider them some of the most important parts of the United States Constitution. And as you might guess, one area where the Supreme Court has been very, very active, and at least in the last century or so, involves the words and, in fact, the images that appear in film. And there's a long, long history of attempts to censor films, and there's a long, long history of legal challenges to that. And I guess I was aware of that, but I wasn't entirely aware of it until recently I received a solicitation from a lawyer. His name is Jeremy Geltzer, and Jeremy sent me an email, as people often do, wanting me to use a book that he'd written in one of my courses, as people often do. And typically I'll glance at them, and typically I'll delete the emails, and that'll be the end of it. But Jeremy's book had a really pithy title and one that really caught my attention. It's called Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures, Film and the First Amendment. And when I saw that, I thought to myself, could I use that in class? And maybe I could if I teach another First Amendment course soon, and maybe I will. But in the meantime, I knew that I had to use it on this radio show. So I sent Jeremy an email back, and he immediately agreed to speak to me. His book is just coming out here, just as this we go to broadcast with this. I should warn you, though, that as the title indicates, that's exactly what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about films. We're going to be talking about censorship. And as you might guess, the sort of films that most often get censored are sexually suggestive, or maybe even sexually explicit, or they may involve other things that some people find objectionable, such as violence and things of that sort. And so if those sorts of things offend you, maybe you don't want to listen to this episode. Or if the kiddies are in the car, maybe you want to listen to some Top 40 for the next hour or so. But if you're like the rest of us, and if you find the First Amendment fascinating, well, tune in, because Jeremy Geltzer is going to tell you all about film and the First Amendment.
I'm an entertainment lawyer based in Los Angeles. I've practiced at Paramount Pictures, Warner Brothers, Lionsgate, ABC Disney. Before my law career, I was a writer, producer at Turner Classic Movies, where I created documentary featurettes and had the opportunity to interview stars like Charlton Heston, Anthony Quinn, Tony Curtis, and I've developed an interest in law along with my love for the movies.
Jeremy, you sound like you've had the coolest career of any lawyer I've ever spoken to.
And that, exactly. And that includes moments.
That sounds like a perfect combination of some legal theory with some really, really cool entertainment. And so, I'm really excited about this. So why are we talking today?
Well, I have just written my first book, which is called Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures.
now I remember why we're talking, because you sent me an email seeing if I wanted to adopt that in one of my classes, and when I saw your email, I busted a gut laughing, and my first thought was, I'm going to have anybody who writes a book about dirty, filthy stuff, I'm going to have him on the show.
We try to make the law sexy here.
I think you've succeeded already. Well, okay, what is this? Tell me the title again, and then tell me what it's about.
The title is Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures, Film and the First Amendment.
So I guess it's about film and the First Amendment then.
That's correct. So a lot of people I guess let me take this back a step. One of the things I enjoy most as a film buff is making lists. Most film lovers do that. The best films of the year, the best films of all time, Academy Award winning films, best blockbusters. So right. I took this back and I started thinking about what are the actual films that changed the medium of motion pictures. And I think a lot of people didn't realize, and I sure didn't realize in the beginning, that movies were not covered under the First Amendment until 1952.
Isn't that astonishing? That astonishing that the First Amendment was not applied to one of the most important expressive art forms out there until 1952?
I mean, you already had Citizen Kane, you already had Gone with the Wind. In 1952, many of the monumental films of the Hollywood system, Wizard of Oz, had already been released, and they were not considered communication or art, and they were freely banned across, or censored, cut, and abridged across the states.
Wow.
So I took that as my starting point. And really, I looked at the movies and the developing law and how both the law affected movies and how film ended up changing and broadening the law. And then I spend time on the characters. The censors are great. You just can't write lines like these censors, because they are, for the most part, really on a mission to save the moral integrity of the people in their community.
And yet, the very people who want to save the rest of us, by their very nature, have to go in and spend their time wading through what they consider to be filth.
Exactly. Exactly.
What an interesting job description.
And these, you know, the last state censor was a real character named Mary Avara. Mm-hmm. She was active until 1981 in
Good
Maryland.
Heaven.
So her last film was a James Bond film.
So oh, my.
The idea that this is not just ancient history.
Well, there are some listeners who would think 1981's ancient history, but I'm not among them.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank
absolutely. You. Say, well, let's go back to the beginning, though. I mean, your book points out that pretty much ever since there has been film, there have been attempts to censor it. So, and your book basically follows a chronological order. So let's go all the way back to those early days, those flicks that were flickering on the screens. And let's talk about some of those early attempts and then and bring in the law as the law develops.
Okay. So in the beginning, motion pictures aggravated the order of things. So there was still in the 1890s this Victorian sense of propriety that controlled public behavior. And motion pictures had women and children unchaperoned in darkened rooms, mixing with working classes who found this cheap as cheap entertainment, and immigrants who were learning how to be American by watching motion pictures. So the venue itself was problematic. And then you had the content. And the first popular content were dancing films. So you had women shaking their hips, which was a violation of this Victorian sense of propriety. As a matter of fact, in 1897 in Atlantic City, one of these belly dancing films was confiscated by the chief of police. So that's the first evidence of, you know, the police going in and ripping a film out of a projector. And
you've already identified two things which are still familiar and two of my favorite things: being in a darkened room with my girlfriend and watching a woman shake her hips. And I mean, those are two of my favorite things. And the movie going public felt the same way back in, I'm guessing this is what, the 19-teens when these movies are coming out?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, actually, we're before the 19-teens. Right now, we're still in the 1890s.
What? I didn't catch that. I know you said that. Now you're reminding me. You said that the 1890s, you actually had moving films that were being displayed.
Well, it's a little bit. They're not projected just yet. Okay. Edison had a kinetoscope.
Oh, of course. I've seen. Yes.
Projector.
Yes. Okay. Now I remember. I've seen those in museums. Okay. Now explain what that is, please.
So this is a device which is about a little over waist high, and it has a viewfinder. You slip your nickel in, and it makes a loud noise, and flip cards flip by, and you get to see a short scene, probably, you know, 20 seconds long, mm-hmm. of a woman dancing. Also very popular were boxing films, because this was perfectly suited for one round. And who can just watch one round? So you plug your nickel in here, now you have to move to the next machine. So it's a great way to make money, and boxing was exciting. Which also raised a problem, because here you have women watching men pummel each other in a bare fist boxing matches. Not only was this brutal, but the outfits that they wore were pretty skimpy and revealing.
That's right. Just as I enjoy watching women shake their hips, I imagine there are a lot of women who liked watching those muscular fellows pummeling one another.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So these are the first instances that start aggravating moral authorities in the community. Maine, the state of Maine, enacted an anti-boxing film law in 1897.
Man.
So it only applied to boxing films, and it was only in the state of Maine, but no boxing in Maine, which of course was, you know, a pretty big business by the early 19-teens with Gentleman Jim Corbett and Robert Fitzsimmons and Jack Johnson, you know, really celebrity boxers. So this was pop culture emerging.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a problem with the venue. We have a problem with the content. Oh, the key film that really rose to the top was a Edison picture called The Kiss.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it might seem very innocent today, but already before you get into the content, dance films were long shots. You got to see the dancers' feet, and you got to see their head. Boxing films, you got to see the ring. With The Kiss, you have a bust shot. It's a medium close-up. So already, you're in the actor's face, which is running contrary to these Victorian ideals of the day. And the film is very simple. You have a middle-aged woman. You have a man with a handlebar mustache. They seem sort of nervous. They're looking at each other. They're looking away. He pulls himself back, and then he goes for it. He lays one on her lips. And that's the end of the film. You put in another nickel if you want to see it again. But
okay, now wait a second.
So
no,
this is a private moment, but remember the device. You're looking through a peephole. You are peeking in on this private scene.
Right. Now, is this a great big old slobbery kiss, or is this a chaste sort of purse the lips kiss?
You know, it sort of depends on who you are. I would say this is you could give, you know, your girlfriend this type of kiss in front of your parents. It's more of on the cheek, maybe a little bit of mouth there, but not that sexy by today's standards.
All right.
So.
And this was controversial.
Very controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's going on in America. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, around the same time, the Lumieres were premiering their first films. And the difference is Edison had a peephole projector, but the Lumieres projected their films. The train coming to the station caused everybody to jump under their seats because it was so scary. And Edison was willing to sell his projector to any customer, licensees of the Edison kinetoscope. The Lumieres were much more careful about who they gave rights or devices to. For instance, Georges Méliès' trip to the moon, very famous, became a famous early director. He was interested in getting an Edison apparatus, and they wouldn't sell it to him because he was just a magician. But there was one guy whose name was Eugene Perrault. And he was the paparazzi of the day. He was the one who took Gustav Eiffel's portrait in front of his tower. He took shots of Tsar Nicholas. And when Buffalo Bill came to town, Perrault was the guy who photographed him. So the Lumiere sold a camera projector to Perrault. And he said, "What am I going to do with this?" And the answer was obvious. He made the first porn film.
So. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Jeremy Geltzer. He's an entertainment lawyer all the way out there in Los Angeles. And we're talking about his new book, Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures, Film and the First Amendment. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more to Jeremy Geltzer. So stick around. Now it's time for a quiz with the Quiz Prez, the president of James Madison University, John Alger.
And on we go to the next contestant. Who do we have now?
Hi, I'm Will, and I'm a history major.
Will, a history major from where, Will?
From Arlington as well.
From Arlington. So everybody's from Arlington today.
Ned and I went to high school together.
Did you really? Well, isn't that sweet? Are you BFFs?
Yes, we
absolutely
are.
Absolutely, tremendous. We're close. Well, I'm very happy to hear that. Quiz Prez, do we have a hard one this time?
Sure. Well, this is, you know, they're getting a little bit harder, I think. We'll see.
Not too hard.
Of course, your history, right? You've got, all right. As we celebrate Constitution Day, it's of course important to remember that our Constitution replaced the original Articles of Confederation, as we just discussed. One way in which the Constitution differed from the Articles of Confederation was that the Constitution, A, provided for the direct election of the president by the voters, B, made the amendment process more difficult, C, created a national government having three branches, or D, increased the powers of the states.
I'm going to go with C.
What was C again?
Created a national government having three branches.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, that's kind of a silly answer. You sure you want to go with that one?
I'm pretty confident.
You're pretty confident of that one? Nobody wants to talk him out of it? No, I don't think we're going to be able to budge him on this one. Is he correct, Quiz Prez?
He is correct.
Well done. See you there.
I would say, at least my own observation, though, while that is certainly true, and we all, of course, learned about the three branches of government, right, in civics, hopefully in high school and younger, at the time, it seems to me at least that the legislative branch had, in some ways, the most defined role, and that the others took some time to really be fleshed out.
No, I agree with you. In fact, back in 2007, I had the honor of addressing some members of the Virginia General Assembly on the occasion of the 400th anniversary of the landing at Jamestown. And in order to do that, I went back and looked at some of the original Jamestown charters. That too, those charters set up one branch of government, and it was effectively the Virginia General Assembly. Of course, it became the House of Burgesses, and all the way down. But that was the only form of government we had for a long time, and so that's what we were used to. And so, yeah, I think that's why it's in Article I now. Everyone knew what a legislature looked like and what it did. But then we had to really figure out later what we're going to do with this president guy. Right. And these judges over here, that took even longer. That took like 10 years before we figured that out.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with entertainment lawyer Jeremy Geltzer about his brand new book, Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures, Film and the First Amendment. Now, this may not be an episode that's best for the young children, and it certainly may not be for you if you find discussion of things like violence in film or sex in film to be objectionable. Indeed, right before the break, Jeremy and I were talking about how film inevitably devolved into pornography. In fact, that devolution was actually very quick. Before we really even had film, we had a fellow by the name of Perot who was making porn film, sort of.
I've often told my students that whenever there is a new groundbreaking technology, somebody figures out how to use it to make pornography.
Exactly. What was amazing to me was it took him 3 weeks. That's it. Between getting the device and projecting his film. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks.
So it was really high quality stuff with a very involved plot.
Well, it was, I think we would call it more of a striptease film today.
Right.
So, but real smokers, blue movies, stag films followed very quickly.
Now, were these publicly displayed and therefore banned by some local sheriff, or were they being distributed sort of sub rosa?
It's very hard to get a handle on early porn because it was underground. Nobody wrote a history of this. I believe that these were shown in the back room at the Elks Club, in the back room at the Foreign Legion.
Right.
You know, these were a men's club. These were not for consumption. These were not at Nickelodeon parlors. But they existed. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, the earliest existing American smoker was called a free ride. And the Europeans were content with loops and clips. Americans tend to like narrative. So that's what the American producers brought to their stag film, is they created a plot. And the plot...
Before you go on, Jeremy, I must say that free ride is something that I had never, ever heard of until you came out with your top 10 list. The University of Texas Press, which publishes your book, came out with this. And, of course, I had to click on this. And I must say this is a jaw... dropping, what, 1915 film?
Same year, or 1 year after Birth of a Nation, to give you an idea.
Just astonishing. And so, I mean, just the very idea that this would even exist back in 1915 stunned me, and also the very graphic nature of the film. So I'll take this opportunity and just warn people, if the kids are listening, we've sort of been talking around these issues for a while, but it's possible during the course of this interview that we'll be talking about some things that are inappropriate for younger listeners, so just be warned. All right, now with that caveat, please go ahead and tell me about A Free Ride.
A Free Ride is, the plot is a man is driving down the road in his Model T. He picks up not one, but two women on the side of the road, and they head to, I don't know, it could be a park, a green space. They lay out a blanket, and with about as much prologue as Edison's The Kiss, they get to it. And the aesthetics of the Blue Movie haven't really changed in over 100 years. But I guess, why would they?
It's basically the same thing. But I guess I always had the idea that pornography had become more graphic over time.
Not so much when you see this.
No.
Isn't that interesting?
It's absolutely astonishing. I mean, they engage in acts that are often, you know, urination is included, fellatio is included, and of course intercourse itself is included. The camera angles are very explicit, and I was just astonished that essentially they did everything in that first film, and then it's just been sort of a repeat over the last century.
Well, I think we lost the kids' audience. So we have this venue, which is problematic because you have women and children in a darkened room.
You have
content, which is problematic because you have dancers, you have boxers, you have kissers, and you have worse. But also the medium itself is problematic because this nitrate film was highly flammable, and you have just immediately Nickelodeons became a rage. So you have parlors opening across America, and you have people fooling around with the device to make films longer, to make them to maximize what they can show, and maximize the duration of the films that they're showing. And what happens is you start having fires, and there's a number of very fatal fires that are caused by the actual medium of motion pictures. So imagine if you're on your internet and you're surfing around and you hit some site which is a little randy, and then your computer bursts into flames and burns your house down. That could be a problem.
It could be a problem.
So
what one might see it as divine retribution.
That's true. You know, not just your eyes on fire, but the physical fire. So those three things together really push popular sentiment towards accepting a level of censorship, mm-hmm, over the content, over the venue, and over the medium itself. Mm-hmm. And I guess a key moment comes in 1907. So to take you back a step, in 1907, there was the first celebrity scandal occurred. And this was Harry Faw, who was a socialite in New York. He married a young Ziegfeld dancer named Evelyn Nesbitt. Now, a couple years before their wedding, Nesbitt had gone over to a celebrity architect's house named Stanford White. Stanford White designed the arch in Washington Square Park. He designed Madison Square Garden, the original Madison Square Garden. Mm-hmm. He was the Frank Gehry of his day. And they were enjoying a play when Harry Faw stood up, walked over to Stanford White, and shot him in the head. Mm. To make this a little bit more surreal, the people in the audience didn't know whether this was part of the show, whether this was an act. And the stage manager, according to the New York Times, jumped on a table and shouted for the band to keep playing, keep it going, keep the show going. And this became a tabloid scandal. While this was going on, a pretty major producer of the day named Sigmund Lubin made a film called The Unwritten Law. The idea was that Harry Faw had the right to protect the integrity of his family and his wife by shooting Stanford White. And he timed this film, Lubin timed this film, to be released with the acquittal in the first trial of Harry Faw. So you have this problematic film, which is a little racy, which is playing into the celebrity scandal, and that was the piece of content that galvanized state censors to crack down on motion pictures and control the content.
And that was in 1907?
That was in 1907. Mm-hmm. And after that, you start having the People's Institute created the National Board of Censorship in 1909. Chicago passes an early censorship law. Ohio, Maryland, Kansas, and these states step into line to monitor the content of films, which is a problem for a growing industry. Because if you are a film producer, you need to have an industrial mode of production. You need to get your film out, and you need to distribute it. You can't make a separate film for Chicago, a separate film for Ohio, a separate film for Kansas. So this is threatening the industrial development of motion pictures.
So how did the industry respond to that?
Well, they struggled with that. There was a major film exchange distributor called Mutual. And Mutual distributed newsreels. So you have timely news that needs to get to its destination. And Harry Aiken, the president of Mutual, brings suit in Ohio, saying he needs to avoid this censorship process. And this is the first case, first film case that goes to the Supreme Court. And it's a key moment. What does the fate of the American film industry? How are they going to counter the challenge of these regional censors? And it gets to the Supreme Court, and it is a unanimous decision that film is not free speech. That is, it is an entertainment, pure and simple. And the court went on to say this entertainment had a capacity for evil that requires regulation. So not only is the film, is the medium of motion pictures not protected under the First Amendment, but the highest court recommends regulating this medium because of its capacity for evil.
And what year was that decision again?
That was 1915.
1915 decision, and the name of the case was?
The name of the case was Ohio Industrial Commission v. Mutual.
Okay, so not only have they essentially carved out an exception for a whole area that we would now clearly consider expressive, they've described it as entertainment, and then on top of that, they said as potentially dangerous entertainment.
That's exactly correct.
That's about as unprotected as speech can get.
This gives the censors the upper hand, and many of the censors are very arbitrary and start banning films for personal reasons. We have a great character in Chicago whose name is M. Let me get this right. It's M.L.C. Funkhauser, Major Metallus Lucius Cicero Funkhauser. Fantastic.
That's got to be the best. You can't make this up. Funkhauser, all right.
And he was the single censor for the city of Chicago, and he didn't like dancing films. No dancing in films in Chicago. He didn't like any type of randy behavior. He was very pro-German, which got him into trouble as World War I was coming down. And ultimately, there's this one film that I saw that was a parody of Funkhauser called Major Bughauser prunes the movies. And it's a film within a film. It's a pretty sophisticated little picture where there's a censor. He watches a film. He doesn't like it. He cuts it. Then they show the cut film, which is absurd. And then he goes and eats a bowl full of prunes. So that's the comedy. It doesn't quite work 100 years later, but you kind of get it. Pruning
right.
a movie, eating prunes.
Right. Okay. Right.
So this was a he was pretty renowned for his censoring of motion pictures. He ends up meeting not a great end in 1918 when he takes his family to the Art Institute of Chicago. As he's walking in, he sees a sculpture of a nude male and says, remove that. Remove that right now.
Wait a second. His brief didn't extend that far, did it, to museums? It was just film censorship, right?
He was the film censor, but he took himself as a moral authority. And this nude sculpture, which, by the way, was a towering sculpture that had stood in front of the Art Institute for months, he saw it, take it down now. It didn't work out so well because, they couldn't budge this sculpture, and they ended up draping it. And Major Funkhauser was dismissed from his duty shortly afterwards.
A little overreach there. Okay. Oh, my gosh.
So to answer your question, how did the film community respond now that censors had the upper hand and were in many cases unreasonable? They turned to self-censorship. There was a period between 1915 and the early 20s that was a little disorganized. But once – I guess in 1919 you had the World Series that was infamous. It was a fixed World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And the Baseball Commission responded with the appointment of a Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who was the baseball commissioner, to demonstrate a degree of self-restraint that now we have someone in charge. And 2 years later, the major film producers of the era brought in the former postmaster general, who was a cabinet level position under the Hayes administration, under the Harding administration, whose name was Will Hayes, to be the motion picture commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about 10 years before he really asserted power in the industry, but that was the beginning of self-censorship. And the studios aligned themselves to avoid racy subjects, violence, drugs, human trafficking.
I've heard it said that one exemplar of what happened when the Hays Code was adopted was Mae West. And I might have the chronology wrong, but she was a very she was known for her racy sort of commentary and her racy looks and all the rest of it. And the story I've always heard is that she was popular, and then the Hays Code came in, and then she essentially lost her career because of this. Is that correct?
That is exactly right. So now mm-hmm. we've moved to the early 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
So the Hays Code was more flexible during the 20s, but once you get a character named Joseph Breen, in the picture. He really cracks down. But in the between 1930 and 1933 was really the golden era of what they called pre-code films. That's where you could get this racy subject matter into the theaters. You had Mae West with her sexual innuendo. You had Marlene Dietrich.
Mm-hmm.
She's very sexy. And you have Claudette Colbert in Cleopatra, where you have hints of nudity.
Mm-hmm.
You also had Bela Lugosi's Dracula and Frankenstein, these monster movies that would not be allowed just 2 years later. And you also had gangster pictures like
Public Enemy,
Robinson in Little Caesar, and and James Cagney in The Public Enemy. The one that got tagged was Paul Muni in Scarface, because that took the violence just over the limit. But it was released in 1932 after much back and forth with the MPDAA, Motion Pictures Distributors Association. But after Breen comes into the picture, the Hollywood films are more tightly controlled under this voluntary regulatory system. So it was not going to be Hollywood filmmakers that pushed the boundaries of free speech. It was going to be independent and international filmmakers. From the international scene, there's a film called Ecstasy. I mean, with that title, you know what's coming.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with L.A. entertainment lawyer Jeremy Geltzer about his new book, Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures, Film and the First Amendment. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Jeremy Geltzer, so stick around.
Apart from Dolly, Montpelier is witness to a long line of women who pushed the boundaries normally prescribed to women in their time. Madison's grandmother Frances, founding mother of Montpelier, took charge after her husband's untimely death, and as a widow inserted a clause into a land grant settlement, granting herself ownership of the property for life. Nellie, Madison's mother, was his solid connection to the past. She provided another emotional pull for James vis-a-vis Dolly. And her dedication to education meant that Madison had the best formal education of any of the major founding fathers. And Marion DuPont Scott, born in a time when her intellect was not considered sufficient to cast a vote, when a woman riding a horse was considered some kind of sexually provocative act, could claim to have chosen her own path. And we can thank her for returning James Madison's home back to the country. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Now it's time to finish our discussion with Jeremy Geltzer. He's an entertainment lawyer, and he's written a book about film and the First Amendment. He calls it Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures. So if the kids are in the car, this may not be one you want to listen to, or if you're offended by such things as discussions of violence and sex. But, you know, if the kids are in the car right now and you really would like to listen, you can always download our podcast on iTunes. Before the break, we had just started talking about a film called Ecstasy.
That was also in your top 10 list, and I also was astonished when I saw, when I clicked on that particular clip. But please tell us about Ecstasy.
So Ecstasy is a film out of Prague that features a young actress named Hedwig Keisler. And the plot itself is going to run into trouble in the United States, because here's a young woman who has an arranged marriage to an older man, which she dutifully goes through with. She is waiting in their bed on their wedding night, and her husband falls asleep in the bathroom, and the marriage goes unconsummated. She leaves, goes back to her family farm, and as one day she's recovering and skinny dipping in a pond, when she runs into a strapping young worker who works for her father and we get to the title of the film. A dark and stormy night. So you have a inadequate male, you have a sexually active female, and you have a nude scene. This is everything the censors fear and want to keep out of Hollywood.
In fact, you skipped over the fact that she is nude by accident. She's in the pond, and she's draped her dress over her horse. And the horse runs away, and so she is literally running across fields completely naked, trying to get her slip back. And it's this young, good-looking man is the fellow who actually recovers it for her.
Isn't that a great scene?
It's a great scene, and she's actually clothed when the ecstasy occurs.
Right. You're right. There's nothing graphic going on here. It's just a close-up of her face, and
that actress
was too much.
That was too much.
For American censors. Now, it was too much for American censors on one hand, but on the other hand, Louis B. Mayer, who was perhaps the most conservative of the studio moguls of the area, he was on the first boat to Europe, and he got there and he immediately signed Hedwig Keisler to MGM, transformed her into Hedy Lamarr, and kept this sort of exotic beauty character that she played in. I think of Hedy Lamarr in Samson and Delilah with Victor Mature.
Hedy Lamarr was considered, correct me if I'm wrong, but Hedy Lamarr was considered to be the most beautiful woman in the world by many people. And she's a woman who seems to simply have won the genetic lottery. She was also absolutely brilliant, and she was born into a scientific family, and she actually did some important scientific work, including channel hopping technology that helped the Allies in World War II and later became incorporated into modern cell phone technology, I think.
Isn't that amazing?
She is just this most astonishing human being, and of course, most people only know her for her physical beauty and in the Hollywood context, but that's just a fascinating little story.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, we don't know what Angelina Jolie's working on. Who knows? She might have her own patents pending.
Who knows? Who knows? Exactly right. Well, this is all fantastic, but I want to make sure we get to the modern era before we run out of time. So we've gotten to the Hays Code era, and we have this fellow Breen cracking down. What's the next major development? Was it that 1952 case you talked about where the court finally applied the First Amendment to film?
That's exactly correct. So what we have is films, studio-made films, are not going to be pushing the First Amendment forward. It's going to be independent producers and international films. And in 1948, Roberto Rossellini directs a featurette called The Miracle, which is a part of an omnibus film. There's three featurettes within this film called Ways of Love. And this film plays in New York, properly licensed, until Cardinal Spellman at St. Patrick's Cathedral figures out what's going on. And he organizes a boycott of this film, finding that it was blasphemous. The plot of the film is Anna Magnetti is a simple farm girl. She is in the mountains with her goat. Federico Fellini happens by, doesn't say a word, but she thinks he's Saint Francis. He doesn't correct her. And after drinking, she wakes up, he's gone, and she's pregnant. And ultimately, she gives birth in a cathedral and rediscovers this new love for her child, which she feels is not quite a virgin birth, but a very holy moment for her.
Okay.
So this film becomes a lightning rod, and Cardinal Spellman wants this film boycotted by all Catholics in New York. Bosley Crowther, the New York Times film reviewer, is on the opposite extreme, and he thinks this is a beautiful and brilliant film and encourages people to see it. And this film has its license revoked by the New York Film Commission and makes its way up to the Supreme Court. And now this is 1952. Remember, in 1915, the Supreme Court had heard the Mutual decision and said film is entertainment, pure and simple, has a capacity for evil, should be regulated. 1952, they watched this film, which is interesting. In 1915, they didn't actually watch the film. They just banned it. In 1952, they watched The Miracle, and they repudiate their earlier decision, and film is now somewhat embraced under the First Amendment. You could still regulate a film, but you cannot ban a film for blasphemy. It's a very narrowly tailored decision.
But that's how the law changes, and perhaps especially constitutional law. And I can see why you say that this is the moment. Because from this point forward now, you're simply arguing about how much protection to give. And I imagine you just had a series of cases.
Exactly. It's onion layers of cases. So you have this moment where film has some protection but can be regulated. In the following years, Lady Chatterley comes before the court, and the court says, okay, you can't ban a film for being immoral. Then a remake of Fritz Lang's M comes before the court, and they say you cannot – this film is not really inciting anybody, so we can't ban this film for incitement to crime. An exploitation picture called Mom and Dad, that's, you can't ban that for being indecent. And finally, the next moment, which is at the end, I think it's 1959, is a film called Garden of Eden, which was a documentary on nudism. And you and I both know it's not really a documentary on nudism. It's an opportunity to show naked people on screen.
Oh, no, no. I'm just curious about the nudist movement. That's all.
Right, exactly. Just read it for the articles.
It's an anthropological study, isn't it?
And the Supreme Court finally says nudity per se is not obscene.
And now we're just going to argue over what nude people can do while they're nude.
There's a great film. Well, I don't know if the film's great. There's a great case called Have Nude Will Travel. And it's three girls in a boat in New York navigating their way to Florida to get to this nudist colony.
And they're all nude.
In the nude, the entire time. And they found that when the girls were in the nudist colony, this was not obscene. But when they were on the boat naked, it was obscene because it's not proper to be naked on a boat.
I guess not.
Well, that argument did not fly. So,
so ultimately, you can be naked on a boat as of the late 1950s.
And I love the decision. The judge admired the cinematography of the film. He went on to say that he loved the cinematography of this naturalism documentary.
Hey, it's art. I mean, that's why I enjoy watching it. Okay, now that does bring us, of course, up to the modern era, even though I'm sure we're skipping over lots of important cases. But even to this day, even now that we recognize that the First Amendment does protect film and that most challenges are sort of peeling back this layers of onion, there are still a couple of issues out there, aren't there? Still a couple of things that you're going to get in trouble if you depict in film. And so what are those?
Well, it becomes more of a political issue in recent decades. So under the Clinton administration, there's sort of a blind eye turned to – now we're talking about new media. We're talking about internet mm-hmm. pornography and obscenity. Mm-hmm. And by not enforcing obscenity laws, that really gave the internet a opportunity to grow and thrive. I mean, these sex-oriented sites were the pioneers who were figuring out how to get your credit card number and mm-hmm. keep your information safe. So I think it was an important time to leave this medium alone. That changed under George W. Bush's administration. Alberto Gonzalez created the Obscenity Prosecution and Task Force, which went after some very visible pornographers, and with great success in the beginning. Joe Francis and the Girls Gone Wild franchise ran into trouble with them. Mm-hmm. The case out of Pennsylvania called Extreme Associates, which was sort of violent, abusive, sex-oriented films. Mm-hmm. Paul Little was in the 11th Circuit. They tagged him. it's this obscenity task force started losing its it's losing its winning streak with the John Stagliano case, which came down in 2010, which he was not – this was, I think, the first case that they did not prevail in putting away the pornographer. Under the Obama administration, this has taken a back seat, although the last case on the docket was Ira Isaacs, and that was came down in Los Angeles in 2012. Where this guy was a shock artist, and they found three films qualified as obscene, and he was convicted. This was not convicted. He was not convicted in the South, in Alabama, or in Utah, or a conservative area. He was convicted in Los Angeles.
Now, without getting too graphic, what these days, what actually can get you in trouble in terms of qualifying as obscenity? I mean, other than child pornography, which is sort of a category all its own and where the focus is upon the harm to the children, what film involving adults actually could still qualify as obscene given the changes in society these years and the advent of the internet and cable TV?
That's a great question. So we don't really... No, Ira Isaacs was the last film on this docket, so it seems that there are no obscenity cases pending right now, not including child pornography. That unfortunately keeps going. That's another line of discussion that I don't get into at all.
Sure.
But there's a list. There's a lawyer named Paul Cambria. Has put together a list called the Cambria List, and it's he advises a number of hardcore filmmaking clients, and this is an informal list of what to avoid, and it is not for the faint of heart.
Okay, so we won't talk about it here, but what if people want to go? They just simply Google Cambria List.
Yes, Cambria.
Okay.
And it's an informal list that some, you know, I think he wrote it for a client and it got leaked somehow, but it will give you an idea of what is frowned upon, what he counsels his clients to steer clear of. On the other hand, we have developing law regarding revenge pornography. These are films that...
Yeah, we've done a whole episode on revenge porn, and since we're running out of time, I'll simply advise people to go and check out our podcast on revenge pornography if they want to. But the issue there is consent and scope of consent.
Yeah.
It's not the actual filming of the acts. It's whether the people in question have consented to being filmed or to having the film shared outside of it. But this has been fascinating, Jeremy. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I think this is a very important book, and it's a very serious book, and it's got lots and lots of quotations of the court cases and lots of good legal analysis. So well done. Well done, and thank you for talking with us about it today.
Thank you so much, Stuart. It's been a pleasure.
And that is our show. Thanks very much to Jeremy Geltzer for telling us all about his brand new book, Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures. When I hear that title, I just think Christmas and stocking stuffer, don't you? Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of Montpelier. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American Experiment.